I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. While the nation was focused on the aftermath of rioting at the Capitol yesterday, the U.S. set a new record for COVID-19 deaths. More than 4,000 people died from the disease on Thursday, according to federal trackers. Adding to the public health crisis, the CDC said a more contagious variant of the virus has been identified in a number of states, including Pennsylvania. Hospitals are being overwhelmed as the disease is spreading more quickly. And while vaccines were developed in record time, the rollout has been riddled with problems. More than 21 million doses were sent to the states, while a little less than 6 million shots have been administered. These new developments are concerning, but one thing has remained consistent: wear a mask, wash your hands, and maintain physical distance to keep containing the pandemic. Today, we catch you up on what you need to know about coronavirus, and we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us by Skype is Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Angela Rasmussen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Allison Buttenheim. She's Associate Professor of Nursing and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She's also Associate Director of Penn Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics. And Allison Buttenheim, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. And we want to give you as much up-to-date information about coronavirus as we possibly can. Well, let's begin with these really concerning numbers, the fact that more than 4,000 people died from the disease yesterday. And perhaps I'll start with you, Angela Rasmussen. Why such a big jump in the death rate?
Well, right now in the U.S., we are at a place where not only do we have out-of-control community transmission, but we also have hospitals in many places that are reaching or at capacity. And when that happens, crisis care protocols go into effect. Healthcare begins to be rationed. And we already have a lot of deaths when you just have a lot of people hospitalized with coronavirus, because the more people that get the virus, the more people are going to get sick and die from it. But we also may be seeing some deaths that are occurring because people are not getting the level of care that they might need in those hospitals because they are, in fact, so overwhelmed. So we are at a really dangerous time right now in the pandemic in the U.S.
Absolutely. I want to pick up on that too. Allison Buttenheim, are we also seeing the result of holiday-based increased transmission of the virus?
Sure. I mean, despite everyone's best, advice and encouragement, we know there was a lot of travel around the holidays, air travel, even small family gatherings, which can end up being a big source of transmission. So from, starting now through probably the next week, we'll continue to see those numbers bump up as more cases accrue from that holiday travel.
In fact, Anthony Fauci says, expect January to be a really tough month, Allison.
Yes, and that's scary given where the numbers are already.
And is it also because it's the winter? I mean, in many ways, this was predicted. This is the winter. People are more inside than they have been when the weather is warmer. Allison, I'll toss that back to you.
I'm going to toss it to Angie as our virologist. But
fair enough. You want to take a crack at it, or I can toss it to
you? Sure. So I think that there is something to that. People have been inside and they are around each other more. In addition to that, people did get together for the holidays. In many cases, people are actually overall traveling more, whether it's for the holidays or for other reasons. People are not taking the same precautions that they were taking earlier in the pandemic. And I think there's also probably an element of pandemic fatigue to all of this, too, that people are just tired of being home. And in some cases, they're not able to continue to take the measures to stay home, to wear masks and physically distance. And I think all of those things are contributing to the rising cases.
Let me ask you about the riot in Washington, D.C. this weekend. And maybe, Angela, I'll go back to you first. Was this a super spreader event? As you observed, not only did you have crowds of people, there was yelling and screaming. There was, looked like not tear gas, but certainly there were, sprays going back and forth. There were physical altercations. Is this the potential of a super spreader event?
Well, absolutely. There was a lot of potential for transmission at the riots and the attempted coup at the Capitol. Many of the people who did break into the Capitol were not wearing masks. They were shouting and in very close proximity. In many cases, I've been to the Capitol. They're not necessarily the most well-ventilated spaces. All of those things can really combine to create the perfect recipe for widespread transmission among that group of people. And we already do know that at least one congressman has tested positive for COVID that day.
Wow.
So we know that there were probably people, both in the rioters and members of Congress and their staff, who had COVID. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to find that people who were there are at increased risk of exposure.
So Allison, what did you observe?
Oh, the same thing. I mean, seeing some of those videos was very, very stressful from a political standpoint, but also from an epidemiologic standpoint. And, you know, we've all heard the anecdotes that as the Senate and the House were sort of, you know, swept away to be sequestered, that there were requests to lawmakers to mask up in these close quarters that were declined, which is really frustrating to hear. So colleagues putting other colleagues at risk in this already very stressful situation.
Which does raise a question. I do want to get to vaccines and some other related issues, but let me go back to you, Allison Buttenheim. It does raise this question about this resistance to wearing masks. Now, it's not universal. When you walk around, certainly when I walk around my neighborhood or Philadelphia, you see most people wearing masks. But this resistance to masking, I mean, if in a perfect world, if everyone wore a mask and everyone distanced and washed their hands, would we be in a different situation, Allison?
Oh, we absolutely would be. I mean, I think we last talked maybe in May or June, Marty,
yeah.
And we were talking then about how do we make it just a habit, just what we do during this time period is you put on a mask when you walk out the door. And we didn't get there. And it got even more politicized as, you know, I don't mask. It's a statement of personal liberty, whatever. Or, you know, I don't feel like the evidence is strong enough, or I don't feel like the COVID pandemic is a big enough deal that I have to do this. And yes, we'd be in a very different place if masking were even, you know, at 80% adherence or 90% adherence.
I mean, Angela, what I know about this virus is it seems very wily, and it feels like, well, is a mask enough to protect me from this virus?
Well, so a mask in general, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of masks. So a mask alone or any one measure alone is not necessarily going to offer you optimal protection. What people really should remember is that exposure risk reduction is additive. So not only should you be wearing a mask when you go out of the house, you should be conscious of physical distancing. You should try to avoid enclosed spaces. You should avoid crowds. You should avoid gatherings with people outside your household. Things like Dr. Buttenheim was saying, even small family gatherings with extended family or friends can be high-risk situations. And as well, of course, you need to apply hand washing, hand hygiene, and disinfect commonly high-touch surfaces. All of those things together will provide you with much more risk reduction than just wearing masks or just physically distancing or just washing your hands. So that's one thing I always try to emphasize to people, that it's not just masks, it's masks and all of these other measures that can really help.
I wonder, Allison, if there is a way then to send out, on the one hand, it seems so simple, but as you said, for some people, this feels like a political statement. How do we have a messaging system that addresses them and gets more compliance?
Well, this is something, you know, my team's been working on, and many, many teams around the country have been working on. What is the right message that people need to hear that's compelling to, you know, to hashtag mask up? And, you know, it sounds like one message that's hitting home is to, and this will hopefully work with vaccines as well, mm-hmm. is to be a protector. You know, be part of the solution here. Even if this isn't about you and yourself and your protection, can you protect vulnerable family members? Can you protect vulnerable community members by masking up? The other, you know, we're in a new moment now. with the vaccines rolling out, we have a new message we have to deliver that is we have to stay masked up even as larger proportions of the population are getting the vaccine. And that's a frustrating message for people to hear. I think there's the hope that, you know, I get my vaccine and my community gets vaccinated and we all get to rip our masks off and run into the street and hug. And we are not there yet, and we will not be there for several months. So there's a new angle to the masking messaging that's going to be a hard lift.
Angela Rasmussen, tell us about there are several vaccines that are being distributed. Some have been used. Shots in arms is a new phrase that I've been hearing. What do we need to know about these vaccines?
Well, right now there are two vaccines in the U.S. that have been authorized for emergency use, and they are they're available in a limited way to people who are in the highest priority groups. Specifically, older people who are at higher risk, as well as frontline healthcare workers. These are both mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine. There are two-shot regimens of a molecule called mRNA that is basically instructions for your cells to make the spike protein from SARS coronavirus 2. This is the protein that's on the surface of the virus particle, and it's what your body mounts immune responses to when you receive the vaccine. So that way, if you're exposed, hopefully you won't become infected, but what we do know is that these vaccines are highly efficacious at preventing symptomatic COVID-19. So even if you're exposed and even if you do get infected, they're very efficacious at keeping you from getting sick. And that's a huge public health benefit. But as you pointed out, or as Allison pointed out, we are not there yet where we're going to be able to vaccinate enough people quickly enough that everybody's going to be able to just rip their masks off. We also don't know, as I just said, whether or not these vaccines can actually prevent infection. What the clinical trials evaluated is their ability to prevent symptomatic COVID-19. So we are still looking into that, and that's research that's actively underway. My suspicion as a virologist is that they wouldn't be so efficacious at preventing disease if they didn't prevent infection to some degree and reduce transmission. But the bottom line is what we need is more shots in more arms more quickly, and we also need people to be patient as these vaccines are rolled out.
And we're almost up in a break here, but Angela, what I was reading is that once you get two shots, your immunity protection is way up there.
It really is. These vaccines have really exceeded expectations in terms of their efficacy at preventing symptomatic disease. They do induce very robust, potent immune responses. And it looks like, based on some other data from the earlier clinical trials, that these responses, at least, will last for months at a time. So that's great news. We obviously still need to get some more. But I encourage everybody to not only get vaccinated when it's made available to them, but to be patient while they wait for it, because I think these vaccines really in the long term are going to be a game changer in terms of controlling the pandemic in the U.S. and globally.
We're going to take a very short break and pick up on that conversation, talk about the rollout of vaccines, some of the problems of making that rollout more effective. That's Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Allison Buttenheim, associate professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, also associate director of Penn's Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics, getting the latest on COVID-19. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we're getting an update on the fight against COVID-19 from our guests. The painfully slow vaccine rollout, what to do about it, a new strain of the virus, pandemic fatigue, vaccine hesitancy, and how to combat them. Let me go back to you, Allison Buttenheim, and just pick up on this vaccine rollout, which has been painfully slow, certainly not lived up to the expectations. What explains that from your perspective?
Oh, I wish it were one thing that would explain it and we could just check it off the list and
sure.
move forward. But so one thing that's important to understand is there's actual supply issues. You know, how many doses have been manufactured and sent out to state and local health departments? And then given those vaccines that are in freezers locally, how many have gotten, as you said, in arms? And, you know, supply is a constraint. We don't have hundreds of millions of doses available yet. But I think what people are really frustrated about is the gap that you reported at the top of the hour, where we have 21 and change million doses distributed to local health entities, but only about 6 million administered.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think the highlights of where the problems are, one is we started this going right into the holiday period. You know, December 14th was the first day we were vaccinating, and it's taking some time to ramp this up, and we did that over, you know, a couple of weeks with several holiday periods. I also have to mention funding. State and local health departments have been just eviscerated over the past several years, and with this particular, you know, enormous effort, have not gotten federal funding to support the rollout. It's really important. It's something I would put at the top of President-elect Biden's list to address. We also, as Dr. Rasmussen pointed out, we're having huge case surges in hospitals, and the entities that are vaccinating right now are health systems and hospitals. They're vaccinating their own employees, and there isn't a lot of extra staff and a lot of extra bandwidth to get these basically occupational health vaccination clinics up and running. So we're going to need some more time to see that happen. And then finally, the last piece, and I'm guessing we'll talk more about this, is are people who are being invited to get the vaccine coming and getting it? And this is still phase 1A. This is mostly healthcare workers, and there's been some long-term care facility vaccination, but we are seeing some gaps. You know, people, not everybody is rushing to the front of the line to get the vaccine, even if they're eligible right now.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things and go back to Angela Rasmussen. And one of the arguments is that part of the problem is that we've got 50 plans because it's basically the states and local public health agencies who are administering this vaccine program. If it were federalized, would that have been a better way to roll out this vaccine?
I think that would be a huge help in this, because really what's happened here is that the federal government, which has, you know, invested a lot of money into Operation Warp Speed, which theoretically is about vaccine distribution and manufacturing, that ends once the vaccines are allocated to the states. And so then it becomes up to the states and in some cases local health departments to actually distribute those vaccines. And as Allison pointed out, those health departments have largely been eviscerated, and there's been no additional federal help. And I can't say enough, I can't emphasize enough the importance of having a robust distribution system, robust logistics, and sometimes that just costs money. The other thing is that, as Allison also pointed out, many of these vaccinations are occurring in hospitals and health systems where people are already dealing with a huge case surge. And on top of that, right now, it's not a great time to tell people in the community, hey, you need to go to the hospital that's overwhelmed with COVID patients to get your vaccine. I think that's actually a pretty unsafe thing to do. And some states have actually mandated that, like New York State, for example, has said that hospitals need to be the only entities that are actually giving out these vaccines. So there have been a lot of problems at multiple levels. And I think this has been really frustrating for a lot of us observing it. I think a federalized strategy to distribute these vaccines more effectively would be tremendously helpful.
Allison, what about if I'm not saying pharmacies are set up to do this, but what about you can get, you know, testing at pharmacies. Would pharmacies be a logical place to pick up some of the slack?
Sure. I mean, we're going to need pharmacies. We're going to need a lot of really creative community-based distribution systems eventually, you know, not right now for phase 1A, to really meet people where they are. One thing I will say about retail pharmacies, and where I think we're mostly imagining big retail pharmacy chains being the entities that are vaccinating, they don't reach every neighborhood. I mean, if you think just about here in Philadelphia, you know, we have pharmacy deserts where there are neighborhoods that are not just a couple miles from, you know, a CVS or a Walgreens. So in addition, I think it'd be great if the big retail chains were part of this effort, but we're also going to need other community-based strategies to reach everybody.
Angel, does it also complicate things that we're talking about two doses and one of these vaccines has to be kept in a really deep freeze?
Absolutely. So there's already, with normal vaccines that require multiple doses, there's already a certain level of attrition that just happens for whatever reason. People don't want to go in and get the second shot, or people aren't able to get in for the second shot, or they just forget. There's a lot of reasons why sometimes people won't complete entire vaccine regimens. So there's that issue. The other issue is definitely an issue of the cold chain. So even though the Pfizer vaccine is the only one that has to be kept in ultra cold storage the entire time, the Moderna vaccine does have a limited shelf life when it's not kept at minus 80 degrees Celsius. So both of these vaccines are a big challenge in terms of distribution, although that may ease up as other vaccines read out their phase three clinical trials and come onto the market. For example, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is going to be a one-shot vaccine, and it doesn't have those strict cold chain requirements. So something like that, if it performs similarly to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, I think will really be a game changer in this regard.
Angela, can you mix and match the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines?
We don't know about that because it's never been tested. My hunch is that you probably can, and I expect that as people, as more vaccines become available and as people are getting whichever vaccines are available to them, we will see some people who've gotten both shots for whatever reason. And we may be able to take a look at that at what's called a heterologous prime boost regimen. But that has never been tested, and so we don't know.
We have so many questions here. Let me just begin at the top here. One from Beth, who says, I'm a 64-year-old woman who is the sole live-in caregiver for my 97-year-old mother. I'm also immune compromised. When should I expect to get qualify for a COVID vaccine? It's unclear which category I would be in the state of Delaware. Allison, we're in Pennsylvania, but what does someone like our listener do to try to figure out where they are on the list of vaccine recipients?
This is a great question from Beth, and I know it echoes what a lot of people are feeling right now. How do I know where I am in line? And because we have, we don't just have 50, we actually have 64 of these local jurisdictions to get the vaccine out. I don't know if everyone understands this, but each jurisdiction makes its own decisions about priority schemes and you know, who's in line first. Most of them are following closely the CDC guidance from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, but there are a lot of local tweaks. So, you know, I could answer Beth's question for Philadelphia. It might not be the right answer for Delaware. Right. So I think what we're hearing a lot of states trying to do is to set up pretty easy, you know, websites that have a little algorithm, just a little, you know, a few questions that you answer, and it maybe tells you what stage you're in. Maybe it even lets you kind of sign up in advance so you can, you know, find out when you are eligible. But that is early days for most states right now. And, you know, not every 65 or 85 year old person, frankly, is going to want to hop on the internet and fill out a survey to tell them when they're ready. So we're going to need some better communicating from providers and health systems and public health entities to help people like Beth know where they are in line.
Here's a related question, or actually two of them. One from Patrick. It seems the vaccine distribution plan in Pennsylvania is a mess. 60% of Philadelphia supply is going unused right now. We should check on that. Why is distribution such a mess? A comment from Janice. I have friends in Texas who are not in a priority group who have been vaccinated. Why haven't nursing homes in Pennsylvania even been vaccinated yet? And just since we're in Pennsylvania, Allison, I'm going to toss that back to you. And then, Angela, we got some questions for you as well.
Right. So, again, this is another really stark example of how every jurisdiction, every state or local health entity is doing this a little bit differently. Even in the first question you got, Pennsylvania and Philadelphia are two different vaccine jurisdictions. So what's happening in Pennsylvania is not necessarily the same thing that's happening in Philadelphia. Nursing homes and long-term care facilities are a high priority group in almost every state. Right now, the focus really is on healthcare workers and health systems, and we talked about some of the barriers to sort of blowing through that phase really quickly. There are a lot of pieces to put together, and the pace, frankly, just isn't where we need it to be.
And that is Allison Buttenheim. Again, she's Associate Professor of Nursing and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Nursing. Angela Rasmussen with us. She's a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. And we're getting an update on COVID-19, the pandemic, the vaccine. And we are taking questions at Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Angela, let me go back to you. What do we know about this new variant of COVID-19?
So there's actually two new variants that are of concern. One was discovered in the UK, and the other was discovered in South Africa. And both seem to be more transmissible. Now, what remains to be a question, I think that most people have decided after looking at the evidence that they are, in fact, more transmissible. But there's still a lot that we need to know about them. We need to know how exactly they're more transmissible. What's the mechanism by which they're more transmissible? Is it because they are more efficient at infecting cells? Is it because they're better at evading the host's defenses against viral infection? Is it something as simple as they are just people who are infected with these are just shedding more virus? So we know what mutations distinguish these variants. But the other million-dollar question about them is, will vaccines produce immune responses that actually work against them? And the good news is, at least for the UK variant, so far, it looks as though the mutation that's of the most concern, which is in a part of the spike protein called the receptor binding domain, that's what binds the cellular receptor in the person and allows the virus to enter and infect a cell. That was actually just tested. A preprint came out yesterday and showed that it doesn't change antibody neutralization at all, which suggests that at least that one mutation is not going to have a major effect on vaccine-induced immunity. However, the South African variant has a different mutation in that receptor binding domain, and that does seem to reduce neutralizing antibody activity to a certain degree. Hmm. But I would caution people to say that even though that is worrisome and even though it's something we need to look into more, it reduces antibody neutralization and it doesn't eliminate it. And when somebody is vaccinated, they're not developing antibodies to just one part of the spike protein. They're developing antibodies to the entire thing. So just because one mutation exists that reduces antibody neutralization a little bit doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccines aren't going to work, but it is something that we need to study more, and it's something we need to continually monitor. And for me, that's the big lesson about these variants. We didn't detect them in the U.S. until much later because we aren't doing anywhere near the level of genomic surveillance that they're doing in other places, including the U.K. So we need to be monitoring the viruses that are actually circulating in our population, since indeed there are so many opportunities for the virus to circulate right now.
Angela, is there a country that you think is doing the best job dealing with this virus?
Well, in terms of genomic surveillance, what I was just talking about, the UK is a world leader, and that's probably why they detected that variant there first. This variant became dominant in southeastern England extremely quickly, essentially outcompeting all the other variants that were circulating in a couple of months, which is incredibly fast. And they sequence about 10% of the viruses that they detect, so new cases. That's a lot of sequencing because they have dedicated funding for it and they have a really robust system for doing that. That said, though, the UK is doing a great job at genomic surveillance, but they're doing a terrible job in terms of the pandemic. They're really in the same situation that we are, in the sense that they just had to order another nationwide lockdown as a result of their out of control transmission. So, you know, different countries are doing different things, doing things well, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're doing everything well. I think that you can look at countries like South Korea, which has a really robust testing and contact tracing system, and they've managed to control COVID. Australia also has a very robust monitoring system and quarantine system. They've managed to deal with outbreaks as they've popped up very, very effectively. New Zealand, Taiwan, Vietnam. There are many countries that we can look to for examples of countries that have handled the pandemic very well without having a vaccine at their disposal. And those are lessons we really should have learned months ago, but there are still lessons that we should be looking to today in terms of getting community transmission here under control.
Allison, let me go back to you. We've got a number of questions about mandating masks, mandating vaccines. What do you think about that? Would that be helpful? Would there be a backlash about mandates?
There would certainly be a backlash, whether it was masks or vaccines. Let me take them separately really quickly.
Sure.
Much easier to mandate a mask, right? It's visible. It's very easy to take on and off. You know, masking status is something you can sort of turn on and off. And, you know, there's a lot of compelling evidence for it. And there's no harm, right? Nobody is going to be, you know, at any harm to put on a mask. With vaccine mandates, you know, the two vaccines we have so far were authorized under an emergency use authorization, not a full approval from the FDA. And we tend not to mandate vaccines that are under an EUA. It's been heard of, but it's rare. And, you know, at least with the health systems that I've been talking to, and I think we would see it most likely in health systems first, right? It would be healthcare workers that would be mandated to get it. Nobody is going there yet. That's not to say in a year or so, the same health systems that mandate flu vaccine might also mandate this, but not these vaccines and not yet. Much harder with a vaccine.
There's a piece, you're in the Philadelphia Inquirer today, kind of a pro-con about whether to pay people to be vaccinated. You're on the con side.
Correct.
Explain to our listeners why.
So I do a lot of work on health incentives for various health behaviors, and it would be tempting, I think, to say, aha, this is one solution to vaccine hesitancy. Let's just pay people. For several reasons, my colleague, Dr. Harold Schmidt, and I argued against it. Not a great use of limited resources, because a lot of people are just going to be happy to get this vaccine. And I think given limited resources, there are better uses of that money. But one other point that I'll raise is when you give incentives, there can be a signal to people that you're giving that incentive because the behavior is risky or hard or unpleasant or difficult. And I think that is not the message we want to send here. Incentives are great for things like weight loss and smoking cessation. For one-off behaviors like a vaccine, I think we've got better tools in the toolkit.
Because it just sends the wrong kind of message, you're saying?
It does.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Again, we've got lots of people lots of listeners that have lots of questions. You can join the conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We're getting the latest on what we know about COVID-19, about vaccines, about how to improve the rollout. And again, Allison Buttenheim is with us, Associate Professor of Nursing and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, Associate Director of Penn Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics, Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about the latest in what we know about the pandemic, about vaccines. We'll be talking a bit more about vaccine hesitancy. Let me toss a couple of questions back to you, Angela Rasmussen, having to do with children. This is from our listeners, a question from Linda. Did children contract and transmit COVID the same as adults? From SG, has the vaccine been tested in school-aged children? What do we need to know about kids?
So this is a really complicated question because despite the fact that where we are in the pandemic, there's actually still not a ton of data, especially about transmission in schools. Those data sets are not being systematically collected. So it's very difficult to say whether schools are a huge transmission risk or not, based on the fact that we just don't have a really complete data set. But one thing is very clear. Children can contract COVID. they can also transmit it to others. Mm-hmm. Whether there is a lesser degree of transmission is very hard to say. And part of the reason for this is that children are less likely to get any kind of symptomatic disease, much less severe disease. So we're probably missing a lot of cases in kids. We're just not testing them as much. We're not recognizing probably as many of the cases of COVID that happen in children as we are recognizing the case numbers that are happening in adults. So as such, our data sets are unclear, and that's why there's been a lot of conflicting information about it. But I think what people should realize is that children are indeed susceptible to infection. So people should be taking the same precautions with their kids that they're taking with themselves. And furthermore, with regard to schools, you know, while the jury is still out on whether we can safely reopen schools, and I think if you have low enough community transmission, you probably can. Right now, we're not in that situation. So closing schools needs to be a very serious conversation that we're having in places where community transmission is really out of control, because schools are part of the community. So if you have an unsafe community, you're not going to be able to guarantee that you have completely safe schools.
Allison, let me go back to you. And you were telling us right before the break about why you don't think people should be paid to be vaccinated. But help us understand the hesitancy to this vaccine. And I've even read among healthcare workers that they are not necessarily all of them certainly lining up to get a vaccine. What is this hesitancy all about?
Well, it takes many forms, and that's true for vaccine hesitancy about other vaccines. And I think there's some added dimensions of hesitancy for the COVID-19 vaccines. I think a big one for everybody is that it just feels like these vaccines were developed very, very quickly. We're used to hearing that it takes, 10 years or 5 years for a vaccine to be developed. Here, we were ready to go in arms in less than a year. Now, a lot of the technologies, like the mRNA, has been, being developed over decades, but it feels like this was potentially, a rushed process. And there's just some reluctance to be, the first guinea pig to get what feels like a very quickly developed vaccine. I think people are also concerned that, while we have the phase 3 trial data, we don't know anything about long-term effects because no one's had the vaccine administered for very long. So a bunch of people are in a kind of wait and see. I'm motivated. This is a great vaccine, but I don't want to be in the first, 10 million. I'd rather be in the second 10 million. And so, I think even healthcare workers who are in a phase 1A are, we've heard many of them say, circle back with me in June and I'll let you know. There is a third element of hesitancy, which, unfortunately has a lot of sort of race ethnic disparities linked to, unfortunately, decades, really centuries of medical exploitation and mistreatment by the medical research community and the government on Black and Brown and Indigenous communities. Yeah. And this is unfortunately the same groups that have been hardest hit by the pandemic. They are also the group that is saying we're not necessarily fully on board, don't feel the sort of trust in the institutions that are going to be vaccinating us to want to be first in line.
So how do we send a message to those groups of people who are reluctant but also at greatest risk?
That is a really, really important question. So, I work from sort of a behavioral economics, nudge angle for most of my work, and these are not nudgeable problems. Right. This is not something where, you tweak a text message that someone gets and suddenly they're there in line. Right. This is much more about long-term, sustained, intensive conversations and question answering that rebuild trust. And we, our hunch is that that's really going to have to go through trusted messengers and trusted institutions like faith-based organizations or like existing, community-based networks where you may need to hear from someone you know and trust about why they got vaccinated or why they're hoping you might too. Again, that's not, wrapping a SEPTA bus with a message that says, go get your shot. That's more sustained and requires funding to really make work.
So if someone like Barack Obama, Kamala Harris, Stacey Abrams, I'm thinking of people who have a lot of credibility these days, are those good messengers too?
those are good messengers. And, you know, that sort of national recognition is great. But, you know, you may also want your pastor,
right,
or your, if your physician, you know, is the same race, ethnic group as you are. This may be more local face-to-face conversations.
And so let me go back to something I was reading actually in today's paper, a CDC report. Now, apparently it's based on modeling, but the headline was people without symptoms are responsible for half of the cases of COVID-19. Is there anything you can say to either expand our understanding of what that headline is about?
Yeah, so this is actually not news as far as I'm concerned.
Okay,
as far
fair
as
enough.
My colleagues are concerned.
That's why you're here.
We've known since early in the pandemic, both due to epidemiological modeling studies like that, as well as due to really systematic longitudinal or sampling over time studies of viral loads in COVID patients, that people generally become symptomatic 1 to 2 days after they actually become contagious. So there is a significant amount of pre-symptomatic transmission or undocumented cases of COVID that are transmitting the virus. That is one of the things, in my opinion, that has made the pandemic extremely difficult to control, because especially early on, before we all knew that we should be taking these types of precautions, you know, wearing masks, staying home, that sort of thing. If you don't feel sick, if you're not symptomatic, you might not know that you have COVID. And if you were exposed to somebody who wasn't symptomatic, you might not even know that you are at an exposure risk. So that makes it very, very difficult to tell people who feel otherwise healthy, no, you should be isolating because you're infected. It also makes it very difficult to detect people who are infected if we don't have widespread testing of asymptomatic people. And in many places, we still actually don't have that. So it is something that I think is one of the main factors as to why this virus really got out of our control before we could implement measures that could stop it.
Angela, let me go back to you. And this is a headline of an article that you wrote. I think it goes back to December. It's in The Guardian. The headline is, "Our immune systems can cope with COVID-19. It's our politicians who can't." But I highlighted that just because I think we're so desperate for some kind of good news. And tell us about our immune system and what it is capable of doing under these circumstances.
Yeah, so one thing that has struck me over the course of this pandemic is that people, I think, trying to make sense, including many scientists, trying to make sense of why this has become the thing that's dominated all of our lives, have really ascribed characteristics to this virus that are really out there. They've almost treated it as though it's some sort of super-powered virus, and said everything from, you know, oh, you're going to get it again and again. You're going to keep getting reinfected. Somehow it's, you know, our immune systems aren't working against it. And actually all the data we have says that this virus is pretty much like every other virus, with a couple key differences. So our immune systems do respond to this virus. First of all, the vast majority of people who get infected with SARS coronavirus 2 develop neutralizing antibody responses. And a paper just came out this week that shows that those responses are durable. They last for as much as 8 months, which is what we expect from, you know, most other acute viral infections. I think what has made this virus unique is not necessarily that it's superpowered. It's really a sort of bad combination of a bunch of different features. It's very transmissible. It's very transmissible in certain circumstances that we did not recognize early on. It's transmissible when people do not have symptoms of it. And on top of that, then we're slow, at least in the U.S., to roll out a robust testing and tracing system. And then on top of everything else, it got very politicized. So even when people were getting good advice on how to reduce their exposure risk, as we were discussing earlier, some people have declined to take some of those precautionary measures. So it's not so much that the virus is so different from other viruses we've heard about. It's not capable of doing things with your immune system that other, you know, that most other viruses can't do. It's actually, in that sense, a normal acute viral infection. You get it, you get sick, you may transmit it to others. Your immune system mounts a response to it. In most cases, that response lasts at least for 8 months, as far as we know now, probably longer. but it's really the way that we've responded to it that has allowed this virus to flourish because of these characteristics of it, such as pre-symptomatic transmission and our own lack of implementing effective containment measures.
Let me read a couple of more comments from Carl. I think vaccine hesitancy is an indication that we've totally dropped the ball on the fact that we have inequities in our healthcare system. Something, Allison, that you were referring to. Kyle says, is it true that even if you have the vaccine, there's not much data on whether you still shed the virus or how? Angela, is there a quick response to that? I think you have answered that.
So if there's can you repeat the question? I'm sorry, I didn't completely understand it.
You know what? It just got erased, and I don't have a kind of brain that can hold on to things like that. So sorry to our listener for. Oh, there we go. It's from Kyle. Is it true that even if you have the vaccine, there is not much data on whether you still shed the virus or how much?
Got it. Okay. Yes. So there isn't a lot of data. And yes, we did address that earlier. So there is some indication from preclinical animal studies in these vaccines that at least animals or monkeys who were vaccinated and then challenged with the virus do have some viral replication occurring mm-hmm. in their airways. But it's probably less than, and certainly in those studies, it was less than in the control group. In people, I would suspect that vaccines that are this efficacious are also going to have some effect on infection and subsequently on transmission. But the short answer is that we actually don't have that data yet, although that is being collected as we speak.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I'll toss this to you, Allison. It's kind of a generic-y, run-based question, but here we are in the middle of a pandemic. We've saw more than 4,000 people die of COVID-19 yesterday. Are we going to be able to get our hands on containing this pandemic?
Wow. I do think we will. And we have, you know, Dr. Rasmussen's summary just now was so great. I want to like pull that clip of like sort of the 2-minute, you know, how we got here and why it's not as bad. But going forward, we have the tools. We have these vaccines now. We know what our other, what we call our non-pharmaceutical interventions can be, our masking and our distancing, our testing and tracing. We have a change in administration coming up, which will hopefully bring some new resources and effort and expertise and recognition of that expertise. There is light at the end of the tunnel. We knew that January was going to be rough, and it's looking like it's going to be rough. But you know, the spring is coming, and I think in December 2021 we'll be in a really, really different place.
Do you agree with that, Angela?
I do. I try to have hope, and even though right now it feels kind of like you're standing at the bottom of the well, looking at a tiny pinpoint of light up above. We have seen examples of how we can successfully contain this. I'm very hopeful. Well, I think a change in administration is not going to magically fix everything overnight, the same way that having a vaccine won't magically fix everything overnight. I think that the new Biden administration is going, and we've already seen some of their plans, they're going to put in sensible measures. And I think from now until the end of the year, as more people get vaccinated, as more people like myself and Allison are out there trying to communicate over and over again, you know, trying to rebuild that trust in public health, I think that things are going to get better. So I share right. Allison's hope that at this time next year, we're going to be in a much better place.
And if we're talking about herd immunity, Angela Rasmussen, what is that goal? And is it a mix of people who have the vaccination, so they have some immunity, and frankly, people who have contracted the disease and have some immunity to it?
Yeah, and that's actually why I think the news this week that infection itself results in lasting, durable immune protection was such mm-hmm. good news, because we won't be able to overcome all of the vaccine hesitancy. And right now, based on some epidemiological studies that have been done in places where the virus has really gone out of control, such as Manaus, Brazil, we think that the herd immunity threshold is probably at least 75% of the population needs to have some immunity. I'm very skeptical that we'll be able to get that type of vaccination uptake within the next year. So the good news is that people who have been infected may be contributing to natural herd immunity, but that doesn't change the fact that we do need to continue getting vaccines out. We need to continue improving public confidence in them, because that really will be critical to ending the pandemic long term.
Well, I appreciate so much both of you joining us today on Radio Times. I learned a lot. Angela Rasmussen, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. She's a virologist at Georgetown's Center for Global Health Science and Security. Allison Buttenheim, thank you very much as well.
Always a delight to be on your show, Marty.
Thanks so much. And she's Associate Professor of Nursing and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, where she is also Associate Director of Penn Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also, download a podcast of the show. We've got a lot of them there, wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.